Good afternoon, everybody. I don't generally have any problem with projection, so let's just have a little sample music here before we get started. Just want to set the mood here. Feel free to break out your own incense or black lights. Sadly. In the year 1964, the tremendous popularity of the Beatles, coupled with an expanding and increasingly affluent middle class, led to an explosion of bands playing music in a style that eventually came to be known as garage rock, although that term didn't come into common usage until several years later. Garage rock could be defined as a musically simple, blues-based form of popular music influenced most heavily by the British invasion bands of the mid-1960s, particularly the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, but also the Animals, the Kinks, the Yardbirds, Them, and The Who. Since the sound of these bands was based partially on the sound of American R&B of the 50s and 60s, you can see the relationship between the British invasion bands and the later American garage bands as an example of a continuing process of cultural transfer. They use our music, they change it around, they give it back to us in a changed up form, and we take it from there in that way. Musician Larry Deal of the band Little Boys Blue remembers the impact of the Beatles. When the Beatles hit and later the British invasion, life as we knew it changed completely and forever. If the Beatles wore a particular jacket, hat, pants, or even belt buckle, so too did we. If the Beatles began to play certain acoustic and electric guitars, so too did we. And we would, in fact, sell our current equipment and go into hock for the balance just to buy the same guitars. I even knew guys who would fake an English accent to impress girls or to give them a leg up in joining a band. I simply can't imagine how music would have evolved without the Beatles. The San Jose, California area, just a few miles down the road here, served as the spawning ground for a very active garage band scene during the years 64 to 68. Sometimes referred to today as Silicon Valley, the South Bay, as it was known at the time, comprised San Jose, Santa Clara, Sunnyvale, Campbell, Cupertino, Saratoga, Los Gatos, Los Altos, Mountain View, and Palo Alto. Why was San Jose such a hotbed of garage rock? For better or worse, the city epitomizes suburbia in its sprawling layout and, as in Southern California, is a car culture entirely dependent on freeways and driving. With all those cars and all those suburban garages, garage bands had no shortage of places to practice and play. The emerging teen culture of the 1960s offered plenty of performance opportunities, and the friendly climate meant that, unlike in the Midwest and the Northeast, bands could practice year-round, or at least out in the garage, without heat. Although San Francisco and South Bay bands shared gigs and sometimes members, the difference between the musical styles emanating from the two locales was striking. As the Beatles' influence took hold, rock moved in a more progressive direction, with songs featuring long solos that seemed to be made more for listening than dancing. The San Francisco scene reflected this, especially in the music of the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead. By contrast, the music of most of the South Bay bands, while often showing psychedelic influences, nevertheless remained more song-oriented. The stylistic difference was also reflected in the types of venues the bands played. The South Bay bands frequently played at teen dances, held in converted roller rinks or teen centers. The San Francisco bands more often played auditoriums in the city, usually for audiences of hippies who tended to be a few years older than the teen dance crowd. The mood of the crowd could be quite different too, as hippie audiences were frequently under the influence of LSD or other psychedelic drugs, especially during the later 1960s. Judd Kost refers to the increasing polarization of the Bay Area into a teen rock scene, founded by the Beau Bremels, and an adult rock scene, traced back to the Charlatans. The three highest profile bands from the San Jose area, circa 65-68, were the Chocolate Watch Band, who you see right here, the Count Five, and the Syndicate of Sound. The Chocolate Watch Band grew out of a number of earlier South Bay bands, including the Chaparrals, the Topsiders, the Shandells, and the English. The first version of the band featured lead singer Danny Fay, but did not record. After a confusing switch of band members between the Topsiders and the early Watch Band, lead singer Dave Aguilar joined the group. This lineup, generally considered to be the classic version of the band, recorded two early singles and then an LP, No Way Out. And let's move to a different slide here. There we go, that's the one I wanted. The Watchman has sound heavily influenced by the Rolling Stones, particularly Aguilar's snarling lead vocals. The band also experimented with psychedelic elements, although their sound remained much more direct and R&B influenced by way of the British Invasion than San Francisco jam bands such as the Grateful Dead or the Jefferson Airplane. These comments by lead singer Dave Aguilar help explain the Watchman's sound. I had a friend over in England who sent me some stuff by the Stones. I enjoyed black R&B and that's what they were playing. I got interested in them that way. I never cared for the Beatles. The Stones appealed to me solely because they were playing the same music I'd been listening to all along, people like Muddy Waters. The Watchman then signed a contract with Greengrass Productions, home of garage impresario Ed Cobb, who also managed Los Angeles' Standells and other legendary 60s garage band, as well as the E-Types, a Salinas band very popular in the San Jose area. Cobb was a member of the Four Preps and wrote songs as well, including the Watchman's first vocal hit, Sweet Young Thing. That's the one we just heard a few seconds of at the beginning. He also landed them a band a small role in the 60s teen exploitation film Riot on Sunset Strip. And I actually have that here. Let's see if this works. JavaScript turned off. Okay, well, scratch that then.
Okay. If you have a firewall, turn it off.
Pardon?
If you have a firewall up, turn it off.
I have no, this is not my computer, so. Yeah. Anyway, let's get a different image up here for you.
I don't think we have internet access.
Actually, I think we do. I was checking at my seat there and it seemed like it was working. So I don't know. But anyway, let's get back to our slideshow. And there's a good shot of them sitting. Oh, note the pack of cigarettes there on the step. Looks like Marlboros, apparently. However, the band was stunned when their first LP, The Inner Mystique, was released. While they had been touring, their record company, unbeknownst to them, had erased some of Aguilar's vocals and replaced them with vocals by session musician Don Bennett. In addition, they even recorded several instrumental numbers for the LP with session musicians. The result was that only 4 tracks out of 10 actually featured the full band, while 2 did not feature any members of the Watch Band at all. The participation of Bennett had its value, however. While the Watch Band may have been furious at the way his vocals were dubbed in over Aguilar's, the fact remains that Bennett wrote what has become close to a signature song for the band, Are You Gonna Be There at the Love Inn? Aguilar has said, signing that contract was probably the worst thing we ever did. To make matters worse, San Francisco's legendary promoter Bill Graham expressed interest in managing the Watch Band immediately after they had signed a contract with a rival South Bay promoter. The band was left to wonder what might have been had they taken Graham's offer instead. Although, unlike the Count Five and the Syndicate of Sound, the Watchmen did not have any substantial national hits, they remain the group that has the highest current profile among the three. There are a number of reasons for this. They made 3 LPs instead of just 1 each, as did the Count Five and the Syndicate of Sound. Their sound had more psychedelic elements than either of the other 2 bands. And perhaps most importantly, the underground network of 60s garage fans and writers that sprang up in later years helped raise their visibility as an important cult band. One could also argue that Aguilar was a more compelling frontman than most. Reports from the era when the band was active indicate they were one of the most popular and successful of the on the San Jose scene. Okay, let's have a little bit more. Now we'll move on to our next band. And we're sure where there's gonna be some recognition of this next tune. Just a little where the drums come in. One of my favorite moments in rock and roll. Oh, not there.
I feel good.
next section got them accused of being a Yardbirds ripoff fan.
This part right here.
The Rave-Up. And there you have it. Psychotic Reaction, the biggest hit of all three of these bands, reached number 5 on the Billboard singles chart in the fall of 66. The band evolved from a South Bay surf rock and roll band called the Squires. The California boys who made up most of the Count Five then added a vitally important new member, Irish immigrant John Sean Byrne, who provided both the lyrics and the lead vocals for Psychotic Reaction. As the story was told by Count Five guitarist John Mouse Michalski, we found John because he lived across the street from Ken, who said, there's this guy from Ireland, he knows all the Beatles songs, he looks like a Beatle, plus he writes originals. I went over there, heard him, and said, good choice, you're in the band, right now, let's go. That's how the story's told here. And there's the Count Five in glorious 60s color. The Count Five had record company troubles too, signing with Double Shot, a label best known for the R&B recordings of Brent and Wood. Give me a little sign. Give me some kind of sign, girl. Yeah. Anyway, although the label did well with Psychotic Reaction, in the view of the band members, Double Shot lost interest in their later singles and failed to promote them adequately in spite of some excellent reviews. However, it should be noted that Psychotic Reaction may not have been a hit in its original form, which included a key change and a rather anticlimactic ending, but the producer Hal Wynn cut a section from the middle of the tune and pasted it onto the end of the song after the second verse as a fade-out. And by the way, just an aside, there's a Brenton Wood album. He's a black soul singer, of course, and there's an album where he sings a Psychotic Reaction, like in a soul kind of version. And it's, I wouldn't call it a masterpiece, but if you're a fan of the song, it's well worth hearing. And I'm a fan of Brenton Wood, too. Musically, the Count Five were influenced by the same British invasion bands as their compatriots in the Watch Band and the Syndicate of Sound, and the sound of Psychotic Reaction, as we've observed, was heavily influenced by the Yardbirds, particularly in that rave-up section. There's a imported pressing of one of their records, and there they are on stage outside. Although they toured with national performers, they only did so on the weekends because several band members were still in school. They became famous for turning down what was reputed to be $1 million worth of bookings in order to continue their education. Although with the draft in the Vietnam War looming, it's debatable whether this decision was based on a love of learning or simply an entirely sensible attempt to avoid being drafted. I probably would have been doing the same thing if I'd been around then, if I'd been draft age at that time. Their other big claim to fame is something they had nothing to do with. Legendary rock critic Lester Bangs wrote an article in 1971 called Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, usually considered one of the all-time high points of rock and roll journalism. In the first half of the article, Bangs writes evocatively about the power of garage bands and simple, crude rock and roll, using the Count Five and Psychotic Reaction as examples. Not content to stop there, he then proceeded to create an entirely fictional five-album career for the band, culminating in the band's magnum opus, the 27-minute-long LP title track entitled Snowflakes Falling on the International Dateline. Doesn't that sound like a record that really should exist? So detailed and convincing was his half-true, half-fiction essay on the band that more than 30 years later, easily fooled garage rock collectors are still looking for Carburetor Dung and the other four albums that sprung entirely from Bang's imagination. And that included me for a while. I wasn't reading carefully enough. And I was just on the web doing a little research for this presentation, and sure enough, on a blog, somebody said, when are they going to release Carburetor Dung anyway? Be waiting a long time. Okay, and our third band, the Syndicate of Sound, also scored a substantial national hit with this memorable number here. Yeah. The CD player catches up with us here.
Done before.
lot of you probably remember that one too. That one reached, let's see here, number eight, I think it was. Yeah, number eight in the summer of 1966, just a few months before the Count Five scored their hit. The Syndicate of Sound had been on the San Jose scene before the Wash Band and the Count Five, and by most accounts were much admired by other area bands for their professionalism, musicianship, and stage show. Their sound was more Beatle-oriented than the Stones-influenced raunch of the Watch Band or the Yardbirds-influenced Count Five, although they started as an R&B band. But after the Beatles became popular in the U.S., the band changed their style. Band member Don Baskin remembers, "The British invasion was a real eye-opener. Bob and I," referring to his bandmate Bob Gonzalez, "said, screw the R&B. We really like this stuff," recalls Baskin. Nevertheless, their R&B experience was valuable. All we had to do was learn the originals on the new Beatles and Rolling Stones albums because we already knew the R&B covers that everybody else had to study, says Bob Gonzalez. They cut their teeth playing in a common ritual of 60s garage groups, the Battles of the Bands. As many as 20 or 30 different groups would play at these events, with audience response determining which band won. Frequently, the prize was a recording contract. The Syndicate perfected their stage show and repertoire at these events. The Syndicate's big hit song, which, like Psychotic Reaction, can still be heard today on 60s oldies radio stations, not as much as it used to, but that's another story, was Little Girl, a sneering put-down of an unfaithful girlfriend. Number eight in the summer of 66. Like the Watch Band, the members of Syndicate of Sound had missed opportunities as well. Their manager, Chuck Patti, in a move that still mystifies band members to this day, turned down an offer to open for the Beatles on their last ever tour in summer 66.
Oh, my goodness.
Baskin claims to still have the letter as proof. They would have been right up there at Candlestick Park, and that perhaps they would have been on the very same video that Richie had there. They were also offered a spot at the Monterey Pop Festival, but turned it down because John Phillips wanted them to play for free. Had they realized what a seminal countercultural event it would turn out to be, they might well have reconsidered their decision. It would have just a pile in the car and drive an hour and a half down to Monterey. Wouldn't have been that difficult, but such is life. But they're happy middle-class guys in San Jose, so they've all had great lives. And looks like the same shot right there that they used for that little Hip Pocket record single. When comparing the San Jose and San Francisco scenes of this period, it's useful to consider the difference in the makeup of the audiences. As we've observed, South Bay bands played more frequently at teen dances, community centers, and the like, while SF bands more often played clubs and auditoriums. While marijuana and LSD existed in the South Bay, they were far more prevalent in the SF hippie scene. The behavior of the crowd, then, has an effect on the style of the music being played, with long freeform solos more suited to a stoned, tripping hippie audience, and short, catchy pop songs more appropriate to a teen dance crowd under the influence of maybe a little bit of alcohol, if anything. In the mid-60s, rock and roll was an almost entirely male-dominated mode of cultural expression. One indicator of this was the competition between the various bands. Dave Aguilar of the Chocolate Watch Band says, referring to their label's habit of using studio musicians and overdubbing band tracks with additional instruments, he says, "It angered us because I don't think there was any group we couldn't blow off the stage." The Count Five's Ken Elner comments, "The truth of the matter is we were actually a real good band." The Count Five's John Byrne remembers, "We competed with the Syndicate of Sound and we actually beat Stevie Nicks in a battle of the bands." She went to San Jose State for a couple of semesters. "I'll never forget Stevie Nicks coming up to me after we beat her and saying, 'You're good, but you're not as good as me.'" Mike Shapiro of Bay Area garage band William Penn and his pals comments, "It always blew my mind that the Count Five got a hit record because they were like the lousiest group, bottom of the bill." Shapiro, interviewed in 1991, shows how the competitive streak dies hard even after 25 years. "I'm a computer programmer now, and someone at my office was the drummer for Peter Wheat and the Breadmen. And there's still this rivalry between us. We thought they stunk." It's in 1991. And finally, Aguilar again comments on the night they opened for the Seeds from Los Angeles and infuriated Seeds lead singer Sky Saxon by performing an entire set of Seeds material as a prank. "Granted, it was a pretty crappy thing to do. We thought it was a lark. Dogs peed on your tree to let you know you were trespassing. The watch band played your music and stole your women. In retrospect, what we were really saying was that we were better than they were. We could outplay them even using their own music." And Dave Aguilar, by the way, is a real character. I've got some handouts on your way out if you want to pick them up there. There's a pink one that has some of the information sources I used for this presentation. And then a really neat map of historic rock and roll landmarks in the South Bay put together by Mark Purdy of the San Jose Mercury News. And then there's a few copies of my whole full-length paper, which includes all the highfalutin academic theorizing that I'm leaving out of today. So no references to Simon Frith today, but they're there in the paper if you want those. There's just a few copies, but I can also send you one if you like. just let me know. Some of the technological advances that created garage music had to do with inexpensive home stereos, polystyrene 45 RPM singles, the saturation levels of television, the most important event in the creation of U.S. garage band culture undoubtedly being the Beatles' appearance on Ed Sullivan. The availability of inexpensive solid-body electric guitars, usually mass-produced in the U.S. or Japan. The solid-body distinction being crucial, as the traditional hollow-body guitar would emit uncontrollable feedback when turned up to a high volume. But combined with wah-wah pedals and distortion boxes and new advances like that, four- and five-piece rock and roll groups could produce a sound just as loud and powerful as a 10-piece R&B group with horns. So another partial explanation for the move from larger to smaller bands, technological innovations made it possible to use fewer members, in addition to the appeal of the style of the four guys on stage. Also in the mid-60s, radio stations had not yet adopted the type playlist that became common in the 70s, so the DJs were often free to choose at least some of the material they played. The importance of the local garage rock scene and the flourishing of the small independent labels meant that in any given city, one could hear songs that were being played only locally. If a song was a big enough hit, it might then be picked up and reissued on a larger label that could do more to promote the record. The year 1966 is generally thought of as the garage rock heyday, if you will. By 68, the rock culture, spearheaded by Rolling Stone magazine, had taken hold and rock and roll was now treated as an art form. Not coincidentally, that year also corresponds to the disappearance of the garage rock sound in favor of psychedelia. Another harbinger of the end of the garage rock movement was the fact that all three of the San Jose bands previously discussed broke up in 1968 or shortly thereafter. Although I moved to San Jose in 2001, and all three of those bands have played a couple, two, three gigs within the last 7, 8 years or so. The Syndicate of Sound remains sort of semi-active. They play a gig a year or so. Count Five, good. I've seen about 4 years ago, and the Watch Band gets together every now and then. Dave Aguilar lives on the East Coast somewhere. But if you go to the chocolatewatchband.com, their own website, you can just put in Chocolate Watch Band into Google. There's a 10-part history of the band that might take half an hour to read or something, but Dave Aguilar is one funny dude, and it's really worth reading. Virtually all garage band musicians were young men, and the hysterical reaction of young women to the music of the Beatles did not escape their notice. The widespread availability of the pill also contributed to the sexually charged atmosphere of the garage rock scene. As Dave Aguilar of the Watch Band says, "I'm convinced that just before practice sessions, 60s rock bands secreted pheromones detectable from outer space by the underage female species of Homo erectus." When Count Five member Ken Elner visited the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland a few years back, he sat down to watch a short film about San Francisco's Summer of Love in 1967. During the introduction, a very familiar sounding song began to play. Let me get Five graphic up here again for you. There we go. There they are looking down at you. Looks like at the bottom of a grave or something like that. During the introduction, a very familiar sounding song began to play. It was Psychotic Reaction, the Count Five's big hit. The only problem was that the Count Five were from San Jose, not San Francisco. None of the band members ever lived in San Francisco. As the Count Five's bassist Roy Chaney said, they would just say we were from San Francisco because they didn't know where San Jose was. Judd Kost describes the challenge of trying to get San Francisco radio stations to add the Syndicate of Sound's Little Girl to their playlist. San Jose began to clamor for the disc almost immediately, but true to form, San Francisco, with its nose pointed due north, didn't want to hear anything from the South Bay. There is no doubt that many South Bay musicians felt slighted by the national attention paid to the San Francisco scene, in their view, not always deservedly. For example, John Byrne of the Count Five says, "We paid attention to the San Francisco scene, but I was never influenced by any of that music. I was especially not impressed by the Grateful Dead, though I liked Moby Grape. Those groups from the city always looked down at the South Bay and treated us with disdain." Judd Kost writes of the Syndicate of Sound's reciprocal disdain for the San Francisco scene. "In fact, the Syndicate had very little to do with the San Francisco hippie scene. We thought things were happening down here and not up there," Baskin states. "And coming from our background of real R&B, when we saw some of those bands doing lousy blues, we didn't want to be associated with it." The Watch Band's Dave Aguilar comments on the Grateful Dead, "My main problem with the Dead, though, I was never stoned enough to ever uncover or appreciate any of their hidden genius. I always thought of them as a really bad country and western band that had accidentally taken too much acid. I was just too impatient to hang around 20 or 30 minutes to find out how a song ended." Doesn't pull any punches. He's a funny guy. Finally, let me sum up for you with this story from Ned Torney of the Watch Band and The Other Side. We went to audition for Bill Graham to try to get into the Fillmore, and we could hear him while we were standing outside his office door talking to his secretary. As soon as he found out we were from San Jose, he tells her, "Tell them I've gone to Los Angeles." So we went over to see Chet Helms. He listened to us, and we played the Avalon that weekend with Bo Diddley and Quicksilver, who also liked us a lot. And the moral of that, I guess, just bears out Ned's golden rule: never tell anyone you're from San Jose. Thank you. Any questions? Anybody? Yes, sir.
I was just going to let you know, I was at the University of Colorado in the early 80s and saw that I was a broad rock fan. I saw there was a guy named Gabe Aguilar who
yes.
He was the head of the
astronomy.
Astronomy department.
Right.
And I went over there just to see if he was there and introduced myself. Turned out none of his coworkers knew that he was ever in a band, and they were all very shocked. Out.
Really? He didn't say boo about it, huh? Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I think he might be on the East Coast now. But yeah, he's a real interesting guy. And let me also, and they're not even paying me, but I'll put a plug in here for this awesome 4-CD box set on Rhino, Love is the Song We Sing, San Francisco's Nuggets. And the second disc in particular, very appropriately named Suburbia, has Psychotic Reaction on it. The other two bands I discussed, plus a whole bunch of other bands from the South Bay and the Peninsula and the East Bay. And two of the greatest garage rock scholars on planet Earth live here in the Bay Area, one of them being Alec Palau, who put this together and plays bass with the Watch Band on their reunion shows, and the other guy, Judd Kost, who has done tons of liner notes for Sundays, reissues, and other labels. I'm a dabbler compared to those two guys. Anybody else?
I just can't let you get away with calling the Jefferson Airplane a jam band.
Don't. Sorry. I like some of their songs.
Well,
yeah. The Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead fits the definition
yes,
much better. Yeah. That's yeah. You are correct.
Until the Grateful Dead were out of business.
Pardon me?
The term didn't get invented until the Grateful Dead were practically out of business.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Blues Traveler. That's a jam band. I guess you're right. I picked up a early single of the Dead a few years ago, Cream Puff War, which is the zine that was the name of the zine that Judd Kost did that led to this presentation. I couldn't have done it without the interviews that he had in there. And it was really different. It was very straight up, short song, kind of garage, you know. I was real surprised. Anybody else? I should get out of the way, make room for the next person. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks very much.